Welcome to This Is Money podcast in partnership with NS&I. I'm your host, Georgie Frost, and alongside editor Simon Lambert and I today is consumer affairs editor Lee Boyce. And it's been a very long time coming, but the interest rate has gone above 0.5% for the first time in a decade. The right move at the right time to wean the country off its spending addiction and get some normality back to the economy, or an ill-judged mistake at a time when our economy is pretty weak and Brexit looms large? And what indeed will a quarter point rise mean for us? Also today, Lee's uncovered more on micro fixing. What is it and why would you bother? Financial advisors, how on earth can you work out if they're value for money? And keeping it in the family, could you cope with being an employee of your kid? Don't forget you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I, where safer savings set you free.
But first, for only the second time in a decade, interest rates have gone up. The Bank of England increased the rate from 0.5% to 0.75%, immediately hitting the 3.5 million people with variable or tracker mortgages who'll have to fork out a little more each month. Now, in theory, the decision should be welcomed by savers, but don't get your hopes up. Despite the vote being unanimous, though, business groups and debt charities have all questioned the move after some weak economic data and fears over Brexit, indeed a no-Brexit deal. So was it the right decision? Why was it taken? And what lies ahead of us? So, not a surprise, Simon, but for you, now you've been calling for this, haven't you, on this podcast, for a rate rise. You think that we were ready for it. I assume you haven't changed your opinion. But with that in mind, just take us back, if you would. Why the fall in the first place after the crash? Why are they so historically low rates? And why haven't they risen up until now? Because surely we're in a better place than we were back then. A bit of an economics 101, as you were. It's the relationship between fiddling around with interest rates and the economy.
The Bank of England Monetary Policies Committee's chief remit is to target inflation of 2%. But also to support the economy. And the bit about supporting the economy has been emphasised somewhat more over the past decade. Now, if you roll back the years to, you know, before the 2000s, it was actually the chancellors that set interest rates. But that was separated and the Bank of England was given independence to set interest rates in order to avoid the scenario where politicians would basically make interest rates decisions based on things that they wanted to happen. So, for example, there was always the suggestion that chancellors were too slow to raise interest rates and too quick to cut them because it gives a boost to the economy. Mm-hmm. Why does it give a boost to the economy? Well, the Bank of England base rate influences the rates at which banks and building societies lend to their customers. And it does this by influencing the cost of money on the money markets. Banks and building societies, when they make a loan to a customer, a mortgage in particular, the bank presses a key on the computer, mm-hmm. the money is magically created. Mm-hmm. The work of the magic money tree. That £200,000 is transferred into your account, except it's not. It's transferred to your solicitor who gives it to someone else to pay for the money. But essentially, it creates more money in the economy. Similar thing happens if they make a loan to a business or a loan to an individual. Now, if you tinker around with the cost of those loans, then effectively what that is that's the price of money. So you or me, the price of money is the cost of a mortgage, the cost of a loan. To a business person, it's the cost of borrowing some more money to expand their business, to invest some more, to buy some new machinery, and so on. If you raise the price of it, it lowers the demand for it. And if the demand for it is lowered, then there's less opportunity for banks to create money and put more money into the economy. If you lower the price of the money, then in theory, there is more demand to borrow that money and it pushes more money into the economy. So what happened through the 2000s was we had a stupendous credit boom where vast sums of money were created. There was a huge demand for borrowed money. Mm-hmm. And that was largely a factor of the fact that money was very cheap and people were looking at things to do with that money and thinking we can profit here. So to give an example, there was a huge surge in buy-to-let through the 2000s as people borrowed money to go out and buy new build buy-to-let flats. And the banks were perfectly happy to do so. The money was cheap enough that people could justify it, thinking they were going to make money on rents. The more people that bought the flats, the more the flats went up in value, in theory. And so the more money that the next person needed to borrow. And we saw a similar thing in the residential market, where people's house prices were going up. And people were then borrowing more money against their houses, and they were then spending the money. And they were believing that because house prices were going to go up, they should buy more expensive houses, which chases house prices up. And then eventually, the whole thing went kaput. Yes.
Yeah, right.
Because in some parts of the world, including in parts of Britain, but mainly in the US, people were being lent money just on the basis that house prices would go up. And because house prices would go up, they'd always be able to pay this money back. And then something shocking happened, which seemed shocking to the Americans, but seems like common sense to those of us in Britain, whereby house prices fell all across the US at the same time. Astonishingly, this had not really happened before in the US, and so therefore it was believed that there was no possible scenario in which all parts of the US could see house prices falling at the same time. Seems a bit weird to us Brits, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. But they didn't quite have the same history of punting on the property market as we had. So when that happened, it suddenly turned out that all of this money that had been lent to people, and then the bets that had been taken on the loans to people and everyone, was a colossal disaster. And the banks suddenly went, whoa, we don't know who owes who, we don't know who we owe, and we don't know who owes us, so we're not going to lend any more money to people. And what you saw is that independently of interest rates moving, all of a sudden the cost of borrowing money shot up, and so the demand for borrowing money sunk, and so you had a problem. So the Bank of England decided to step in this country. In the US, the Fed had already rapidly cut interest rates. The Bank of England went hacking away through the jungle of interest rates, and it took rates down from around about 5% to 0.5% in March 2009. And then they stuck there because the emergency measure was decided to be needed all the way through to just after the Brexit vote, when rates were cut again without ever having risen. It was always expected that it'd be a couple of years. I mean, Mervyn King made this speech about the lost decade around about that time, but even that wasn't talking about the expectation of interest rates staying that low, and in fact going lower before they went up. But this week...
So why have they? Why
well, this week, the Bank of England has decided that finally the economy is in rude enough health that we can stomach interest rates of a princely 0.75%. The financial crisis is over, people. It's party on time.
And yet, if you listen to a lot of people, you'd think they'd raised it 75%. It was a Danny Blanchflower earlier saying he thinks this might prove to be the biggest mistake made by the Bank of England since missing the 2008 crisis altogether.
Well, it might be, but he's very, very vehemently opposed to a rate rise.
Look, the 0.25%.
The argument against this is that the economy isn't doing all that well. Consumers in particular are suffering. We do have a lot of debt.
Hang on, so companies, is the economy doing well or is it not, right?
Well, because you have some people who are doing okay. It's doing okay under the circumstances of this no-deal Brexit that's hanging over us, but that there are already signs of stress emerging, and that to raise interest rates at a time of stress emerging, the catastrophe on the high street, consumers struggling, pay rises not really being that great, they're going up by a tiny little bit more than inflation. Inflation is coming down towards 2% anyway. We've got this prospect of Brexit hanging over us, which is going to act like a big break on the economy. So the argument against this is that, why do this now when it's such a risk?
But also, why unanimously? Wasn't it 6-3 against last time?
Yeah.
And now it's 9-0 in favour.
Almost makes you think, like, when they voted 6-3 last time, they'd already decided that they were going to vote 9-0 next time, doesn't it? I mean, so they meet, they see all the evidence from the Bank of England's economists and the people who work there. They put it before the Monetary Policy Committee, and then they make a decision. I mean, I like to think that it's like 12 angry men. I'd love to see, you know, Mark Carney marching passionately around the room, convincing people to go for his side. Or maybe someone has managed to convince Mark Carney to go for their side. But what this indicates, and there's a couple of things in there that indicate this, is that they think the economy is in rude enough health to do this now. But there's a couple of caveats. One, I think they did this because they felt they had to.
Why? Because they'd made enough noises about it?
There was talk of them raising in May. Everybody thought they were going to raise in May. And then all of a sudden, a couple of weeks beforehand, Mark Carney said, well, you know, May looks all right, but there might be other times that look good too. And the rate rise just dissipated immediately. This time round, that didn't happen. So if they hadn't raised yesterday, there would have been even more accusations of the whole unreliable boyfriend and everything like that. I think Mark Carney's a strong enough character to basically bat that one off. But I think that's in their mind. I think the other thing is they know that they need to try and get rates up before a recession hits so that they can then cut them if they need to. Yes. They have a lot more leeway than they did last week when rates were at 0.5%. And also what's interesting in the report yesterday was that whilst rates have gone up now, which is possibly a little bit earlier than people expected, they're forecast to go up more slowly after that. So actually the shift in interest rates for us, for the US and for the Eurozone has moved backwards since May. So they're expected to go up more slowly now. And this is to do with all kinds of things, you know, like Donald Trump's trade war with China and stuff like that.
Do you think this could be a one-hit wonder, though? I mean, could we be talking about this in, you know, 10 years' time and say, oh, we've got the third one?
Well, it might be. I mean, I think that rates will get back to 0.5% before they get to 1%. But, you know, you never know. Maybe they'll go, right, November, 1%. They'll get to 1% before then. But the forecast that they had yesterday didn't show a move to 1% until the middle of next year. And then in 2020, we were going to get to the heady heights of 1.1%. So to get to the next rise, because they do it, they tend to do it in quarter points, to get to 1.25%, we could be waiting, you know, to the end of 2021. That's a long time.
It is a long time.
And we'll probably have a recession before
a lot to come before that stage as well. Lee, I have not forgotten about you at all. Be that as it may, the arguments for or against, was this the right time? We are where we are at the moment, and that is with a little rate rise. And that little rate rise will be felt the most by those who have the least, I imagine.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's going to hit people that have mortgages that are on a variable or tracker rate, for example, and they might be people that, for whatever reason, haven't switched to a fixed rate or can't switch to a fixed rate, and that's going to put more pressure on their monthly outgoings. There's been lots of talk about, well, it's going to be good news for savers. The rate's going to be passed on in the form of savings rates.
What did we see in November, Lee, when it rose last time?
We really haven't. But the thing is that the link between base rate and savings rates, you know, is completely out of sync compared to how it was in previous times. So to be honest with you, I mean, the main battle with savings, as we've said in the past and have been saying for the last couple of years, comes in the form of fixed rate savings. It's very unlikely that a base rate rise is what stimulates the competition in that sphere. And actually, Mark Carney said this morning, he was on the Today programme, and he said that savers need three elements for savings rates to go up. Number one was healthy banks. Well, I feel like we're kind of in a stage now where healthy banks are, that's a tick. I mean, we've seen results today from RBS, you know, looking like there's some green shoots of recovery and everything there. Banks are looking healthier than they did, certainly look healthier than they did 10 years ago. More competition from new entrants. Well, we've had a glut of new entrants come into the market, savings market, in the last couple of years. So I don't know how many more new entrants are needed to push up rates to an actual above inflation, you know, level for people to get a proper return. And then he said new products and services from fintech. Well, I feel like that's already being ticked as well. We've got things like peer-to-peer. It's not really doing enough to get savings rates heading higher than what's needed. And people like having financial services compensation scheme protection, so they want to like invest their money, put their money into a safe place like that to get an interest, like, you know, get a return. And it's not happening. And Mark Carney's saying that this morning. It's almost saying, well, you know, this base rate rise is not going to do much for savings rates. And actually, very few providers have put up rates today. And very few rates are linked to base rates. So, for example, some big banks this morning have said, well, we're going to pass on this to savers, but in the form of variable rate savings. That's a very small part of the market. It's nothing. In fact, Skipton Building Society, they're putting their lifetime ISA up by 0.25%, passing on the rise, which is, you know, it's a good move. That's a good move.
Well, it's just fair, isn't it? Because immediately, within a couple of hours, I think it was, Barclays passed it on to their variable rate mortgage customers, that 0.25. Did they do it with the savings? Well, I don't think they did.
No, they didn't. But it's not linked, you know, their main savings book isn't linked to base rate, so why would it? Whereas, like, you know, they'll argue that their SVRs and those sort of rates are linked to base rate, and that's what, you know, people are used to. But you're right. I mean, and it's not just Barclays. I mean, it's been across the board. So 2-year fixed mortgages are even up. So we're not even talking about variable rates here. So there's been a number of providers that have already put up by sort of, you know, at least a little bit. And that's Barclays, but it's also First Direct, it's Halifax, and it's even building societies, Leeds, Yorkshire. All of those really good 2-year rates are already getting pushed upwards a little bit. Okay, it's not by a huge amount.
No.
And we've had it very good. You know, homeowners and people looking at to get a mortgage have had some absolutely superb fixed rates in the last few years. But there's always going to be winners and losers in this sort of thing. There's probably going to be more losers, I'd imagine, than winners. And actually, there was also, outside of savings and mortgages, there were some stats out about credit card holders.
Yeah.
You know, credit card holders are going to probably find it, they're going to be stung for more money. So Andrew Hagger, Moneycoms, said if you're with if you've got a credit card with Barclaycard or Halifax, your interest rate is linked to base rate. Mm-hmm. So higher rates will kick in straight away, right? So I mean, that's not good news for people that are perhaps living on credit and struggling. He estimates that if all car providers were to raise rates by 0.25%, it would cost UK borrowers a combined 92.25 million in extra interest charges per year. Doesn't sound like a huge amount, but it is. People, you know, and people are struggling. So,
and this is what the debt charities are arguing at the moment. People are going to struggle with this. While a lot of the rises will be, you know, 20 quid extra a month, mm-hmm. say, on a standard mortgage mm-hmm. over 25 years, you know, this all adds up and it could push a lot of people over the edge. But where is the balance to be had? Because we got figures out this week, didn't we, Lee, about how much we are going out and spending on mm-hmm. our credit cards and loans and all this. Mm-hmm. And with that in mind, Mark Carney and the Bank of England have been worried about this for a long time and trying to do something about it. And obviously, they're not politicians, and I want to point that out. They're mm-hmm. not. But what can we do? Because this economy is so linked to us going out and spending.
That's it. And it's a good question, Georgie. And it's, you know, like the circle of economic life, isn't it? I mean, it's quite hard to, you know, put all of those things together and to get the balance right for absolutely everyone in this country. It's a near impossible job. But the one thing I will say in terms of, you know, interest rates, if they do go up in the next 3 years, as forecast in that report, it's going to be very slow and gradual. Mm. And if you are finding it difficult with a 0.25% rise, especially something like your mortgage, then, you know, alarm bells should be ringing. You should be able to, you know, you've taken a mortgage out and let's say you are on a tracker or an SVR. You've got to think about the fact that mortgage rates have been so incredibly low. You don't have to go that far that back in time to see, you know, really quite. Some people would look, you know, let's say someone had bought a house in the sort of last 5 years, would look at some mortgage rates from, you know, the past and go,
And we have got the new review, didn't we, that came new now, it's 2014, that should be a bit stricter. So we shouldn't have so many people.
Exactly. So they stress test all of this sort of stuff now. So, you know, looking at your earnings and looking a little bit ahead. And they do stress test way higher than, you know, a 0.25% base rate rise. So, you know, it's very easy to say, but, you know, some people, especially if you've got a big mortgage, this could be a relatively sizable whack.
Yes, and the size of that whack has the potential to derail some of these people's savings, because there was an interesting chart in the Bank of England inflation report yesterday. Households with high mortgage DSRs have more savings than in previous years. So what's a high mortgage DSR? Mm. Well, that is a debt servicing ratio. So basically, those are people who are calculated as total mortgage payments as a percentage of pre-tax income is defined as 40% or greater. And their median savings is higher than they had in the sort of beginning of 2016 at £4,000. And that's been pretty steady for the last few years, but is lower than it was earlier than that, but is higher than it was during the crisis. But the median savings for those people is £4,000. So you are the kind, if you're one of those people who is struggling with their mortgage, and there's a big chunk of people out there who've still got fairly sizable interest-only mortgages and so feel the pain of an interest rise that bit more, then you might find yourself depleting your savings quite quickly. So people do need to take a look at their financial circumstances, and if they think that they're going to struggle with rates going up, they should do something about it.
In some, Simon, a lot of people who don't really get it will think, okay, so the Bank of England have raised interest rates by 0.25% and everybody seems to be going bananas about it, but it seems really small. What is not the worst case scenario, but what are people so worried about? Is there a reason to be worried about, or can we just, will we just suck it up and just carry on as normal?
No, if interest rates can go up at the path that the bank has indicated, then we've got nothing to worry about. They're not going to go very high. They're probably peaking this cycle at about 2 or 2.5%, and I doubt they'd even get that high. And I'm pretty sure that most people should be able to cope with that. It sounds like a pretty harsh thing to say, but if you have a large number of households and businesses that cannot cope with interest rates going up by 0.25% or peaking at 2 to 2.5%, then what you have is a zombie economy. And by a zombie economy, we mean people and businesses that are just hanging on and keeping going due to these low rates. But these low rates are distorting all the other parts of the economy. And there is an argument that what you need is creative destruction in economic terms, which basically means that businesses that can't cope go to the wall, and then new businesses, you know, rise out like a phoenix from the flames. And it sounds really harsh, but that is kind of the way that capitalism and boom and bust works. And what we've done is we've had the boom and then the bust, and then we've done everything we possibly can to try and stave off some of the consequences. But there is a school of thought that says that those consequences are necessary in order to properly recover from that. However, what we did get since the interest rate decision yesterday was Mr. Carney coming along to stir the pot a little bit more. It was almost like he gave the sort of, you've had what you want, you got your interest rate rise announcement, and then he turned around and punched everyone in the gut. Because he gave a little talk about the high risk of a no-deal Brexit and what might happen then, and that they'd stress-tested the bank. So he was reassuring us by saying, we have considered this high risk of a no-deal Brexit. We have stress-tested the banks. Don't worry, we've tested, they've got enough capital. And it's for a scenario where rates go to 4%, unemployment hits 9%, house prices fall by a third.
Wow.
Oh, and we'll get a recession. As if you could get all of those things without having a recession. So we got that little sucker punch in there saying, hey, look, people, this is what might happen. Now, he wasn't suggesting that that would happen, but he was saying, look, you know, you need to worry about this, which you could either take two lines of thought on that. I guess it depends on where you come from. You could think that it's obviously perfectly sensible for the Bank of England to be stress testing banks on the prospect of a no-deal Brexit and bad stuff happening, because the prospect of a no-deal Brexit does appear to be sort of swirling around, and there does appear to be a chunk or niche of people who seem to wield a hefty amount of power who seem to want a no-deal Brexit. Mm-hmm. Like buccaneering Britain's just going to go out there, pull its socks up and just make the world and Britain a better place.
Also, you'd expect the Bank of England.
Of England to be saying, well, hang on a minute. It's not only the sunlit uplands. You know, some bad stuff might happen. Or you might suggest that Mark Carney is just one of the original architects of Project Fear, and he's an arch Remainer, and he's just doing this in order to try and stop Brexit. Make your own decision.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I Premium Bonds, giving you the chance every month to win up to £1 million tax-free.
Right, well, let's move off Mark Carney and Brexit and stick with the savings theme, though, Lee, because it's not often I can say I've made a potentially significant impression in the sphere of finance, or in indeed any sphere at all. But I don't care. I am totally owning this one, Lee. It's micro-fixing. Now, we spoke about it a few weeks ago. Mm-hmm. And it's the rise of accounts where you fix for 3-6 months. Mm-hmm. And I reckon I coined the phrase on this very podcast. It is all mine. It probably isn't, but I don't care. Because last time we spoke, though, these were so new, we didn't have a huge amount of information. So I charged you with going away. Mm-hmm. You would have done it anyway, because you're that sort of intrepid journalist, and finding out a little bit more about it, Lee. So what are they, and what is the damn point?
Yeah, I'll run through this pretty quickly. You did coin the term micro-fixed accounts, and I liked it. And I thought about it, and then I thought, I'm going to write a story about it, and I'm going to get a little micro-pig into the story. And that's what I did. And I went out And I investigated what they're all about. So a couple of the newer banks have started launching these in the last few months, 3 month and 6 month accounts, which is quite unusual. Never really seen that before. Usually you have a fixed rate for a year or more. Very unusual to have a fixed rate this way. But some of the actual rates aren't too bad. So Atom Bank, for example, have a 6 month account at 1.8%, which is not too bad considering that the Best Buy Easy Access rate is 1.4%. So I was thinking actually it might suit some people that just, you know, might have an event in 6 months time, a holiday or something, that they've got a lump sum, they want to put it in for 6 months, maximize what they can get out of it, and at the end of that 6 months, you know, they've got that rate, and it's not too shabby at all.
At the end of that 6 months, do we know what the rate would go to?
It just converts into their sort of standard account, which I'm not too sure what it
is. You'd have to be pretty switched on, wouldn't you?
You've got to be pretty switched on. This is not an account for someone who, that FCA report last week, yeah, you just leave your cash somewhere and then it just, like, you know, completely boils down to a tiny little rate that you've forgotten
about.
It's
like 71% or something of people are on the sort of worst kind of easy access, paying on average 0.53% or something.
So this is it. And actually, that's a very good point, Georgia, because if we keep doing it, and if savers keep leaving their money in these big banks, the big banks are never going to start offering good rates. And we can keep moaning about how they're not offering good rates, but if we're leaving 70% of our savings cash in accounts that are paying probably less than 0.5%, well, who is to blame? Is it the banks to blame, or is it our own, you know, fault for
inertia,
just leaving it?
Yeah.
And actually, I was thinking about it as well. You know, a lot of people do like to have their savings linked with their current account. So you might have your current account with one of the big, you know, four or five, but you also won't want to keep your savings with them because it's all on for ease.
It's convenient.
It's
convenient.
You see it one place. But you're not getting a good rate for that. And, you know, I really do urge people to sort of go out and have a look at our independent savings tables. And look, rates aren't absolutely phenomenal. We know that. But the only way they're going to change and start heading upwards is if we start making a move and start moving our money into other accounts and start getting better rates. Anyway, I'm going off.
I thought we were talking about microfixing, but I love where you're going anyway.
Sorry, I'm going off on a bit of tangent here. So I spoke to an expert who is a former head of savings at a challenger bank, and he sort of was a bit stumped by it. He was kind of, I've got absolutely no idea why, you know, as a former head of a savings bank, I would never have thought about doing this. He reckons that one of the big reasons for it is actually just to sort of like hook people in. And then at the end, if they've looked after your money, you know, and it's been fine, you might then reinvest at the end of the 3 month or 6 month
period.
Almost like giving them a try. It's like a way to give them a try, see how easy it is to use their services. And then, you know, especially like Atom Bank, they keep offering some very good 1-2 year fixes anyway. Some people are a little bit hesitant to use Atom Bank because it's an app-only bank. So you think about, a lot of savers are older people, and they might not be comfortable opening an account with a selfie that sounds very rude. I'm sure there's lots of people that would be willing to do that, but there's quite a lot of people.
I'm not sure I would. As elderly,
people might have a big chunk of savings and they don't feel very comfortable doing that. They like to know that there's a branch network, or, you know, other ways that they can access their money rather than just for an app, or then having to phone up if that app, you know, goes a bit wrong. So he thinks it might be that, and he also thinks it might be new banks plugging gaps in their funding. So if they need it for something and they need to get money in quick, they might offer accounts, you know, so they know exactly how much they want to fill with a 3 month or a 6 month or a 12 month deal. And if they can meet that target and then they know what they're doing with the money, it's kind of like the whole balance between sort of like getting the deposits in and what the bank is then using those deposits for, whether it's to lend out to small businesses, mortgages, personal loans, car finance. That's a big one now. So that's why they're being offered. He seems to think, though, that this won't be a growing trend. He doesn't think that there's going to be many more savings providers that start launching these. Perhaps some of these banks are just giving them a try just to see if there's any appetite for them and how they work out.
Do you think it'll be more the challengers as opposed to the sort of bigger traditional ones?
It would definitely be the challengers, because I would say that and challenges are a little bit more nimble. They're able to offer these things probably with a little bit less red tape and a little bit less rigmarole. You know, a lot of these banks now, you know, have brand new fresh IT infrastructures, where some of these other banks, you know, very clunky, you know, difficult to manage. You know, to be honest, it's not great. And actually, going full circle now, back to Mark Carney comments this morning, this is exactly, you know, the sort of thing that he's saying should be stimulating savings rates, you know, new entrants and you know, innovative things in the savings world. So hey, Mr. Carney, why aren't rates going up even further then? You get on this show, you get on this podcast next week and you tell us.
Good question, good question. Okay, well, I tell you what, you probably don't need proper advice to work out whether to micro-fix or not. You can probably work that out yourself if you like to. But I imagine there are many areas, certainly of mine, but of your personal finances as well, that could benefit from professional attention, shall we say. So the problem, though, with getting financial advice, and that's what we're talking about now, is, of course, you have to pay for it, obviously. But how do you work out if what you're paying for is good value? I mean, what happens if they suddenly start demanding more? Well, this is exactly what happened to two of This Is Money's retired readers. They've been retired for 3 years and they got in touch with you guys. Now, they have their pension invested through their financial advisor and they've been paying his fees on a monthly basis during that time. But they then got a letter saying he wanted his fees paid up front in a lump sum almost immediately. And it was not a small amount. It was 10 grand. And they want to know if it's compulsory or do they have a choice? Simon, take up the story because there's other bits to this as well.
This is an interesting question because the reader goes on to say, I rang to ask him why this was happening and he said our capital had dropped. We recently took out a lump sum to fund our new home. And because markets were buoyant at the moment, it would be a good idea. We're still not sure this is okay and ask your opinion. So it's almost as if the advisor was saying, this will help you out. This would be good for you. Now, we looked into this and we spoke to a legal advisor at Which Money. Mm-hmm. And what came back was basically what I think common sense would tell you as well, is you need to be speaking to an advisor in this situation and saying, what's going on here? It's not enough to send a letter. This needs to be explained to you. Why are you suggesting this? What is this money for? Mm-hmm. Is it for services that we have had previously? Is it for services that we are going to have in the future?
And they got none of this, presumably.
No. And also, most importantly, why do you think this is a good idea?
Yeah.
Because why is it a good idea for us? And also, why is it a good idea for you? Because you're not going to be suggesting it whether it's a good idea for you. Now, I suppose in theory, there is a potential prospect where you could argue that this might work out for a client. So if you're being charged a percentage of your total assets, then and you've taken some money and your pot's down because you've taken some money out, and that would mean that at the moment that charge would theoretically be lower. So if you work out that charge as a percentage of the assets for the next year ahead, and then you pay that whole year's charge up front for the year ahead, mm-hmm. now when your pot is lower, then you would be paying less money. It might be a lump sum, but it's that percentage over the next year. Of course, there might be a spanner in the works there. What if the stock market falls? What if your portfolio falls in value over the next year? Well, if your portfolio falls in value over the course of the year, you'll have paid out a percentage-based fee on a higher value, mm-hmm. not a lower value. But also, I think the key question here and the thing that it would make me very suspicious about, and one which was raised by our expert as well, was, is this something to do with a problem with the advisor's finances? Is the advisor exactly. or the firm that they work for got some kind of cash flow issue, which means they're asking people for money up front rather than money every month? And if so, you might want to be worried about that, because if you're paying for the year ahead's worth of services and they've got cash flow issues, what happens if that advisor goes out of business? Well, you're mm-hmm. not going to get the rest of the year's work from them, are you, that you've paid for? And then there comes into it the FCA element. The FCA rules state that advisors must disclose their charging structure, must be able to understand it, and they must notify you of any changes in writing and in advance and explain them.
It doesn't sound like that's what's happening here.
No, exactly. And then there's also another thing that you need to think about, where if your investments are down, so say for perhaps in this case it's because they've taken some money out, if your investments are down because the market is down, yeah. then it can be a bad idea to pull out a lump sum because you're taking money out when your assets are down. And you're probably selling at a lower price than you need to, rather than if you hold on for the long term, then those assets might rise again.
Lee, one of the questions that a lot of people ask. Are they worth it? Is it worth getting financial advice? Because you do have to pay quite a lot. 10 grand is a huge amount here. How do you know you're getting a good one?
To be honest, the demand for that, I would feel quite uneasy at that. I mean, that just seems to be completely out of the blue. And if that's not something that you have agreed with in the first place, if you're going to get a financial advisor, and financial advisors do work for some people, especially if you've got large pots of money and you don't really know what to do with it, a good advisor can be worth their weight in gold. How to find a good one? Well, that's a good question. I mean, it's always good, you know, to get someone that perhaps is like a friend of a friend, or, you know, someone a family member uses or something like that. But you need to find out. You need to have a game plan, really, with them. You need to know exactly what they're going to be doing. And if you pay to have just an initial meet with them, and it might be 50 quid, it might be 200 quid, they might charge by the hour, you can always walk away from that. All right, you might be a couple of £100 out of pocket, but if you don't get the right feeling and you don't think they're right for you, well, you live and learn a little bit. At least you're not then getting a demand for £10,000 further down the line from completely, you know, out of the blue. So you need to see what their plan is, and to have a contract that's really sort of, you know, this is a monthly fee that you're going to be paying, or this is a percent of your wealth that we're going to be deducting, you know, on an annual basis. It needs to be very clear. If it's not clear, then I'd be getting quite worried. And also these days, a lot of people can, you know, get their own financial advice by coming onto our website, onto other, you know, newspaper finance websites. There's an absolute Pandora's box of advice around about everything from investments to savings to property to inheritance tax to, you know, everything that you can think of. And not everyone would feel comfortable or confident enough to do that, but I would definitely sort of try and arm yourself with as much knowledge as possible before you start going, you know, really quickly in deep with a financial advisor. That you'd like to think that the industry is good enough to weed out the bad guys, you know, people that are perhaps, you know, a little bit unscrupulous. And but the large majority of financial advisors, the good ones, as I say, are worth their weight in gold.
It's not if even you've about got necessarily being unscrupulous, though. You could just be not very good.
Exactly.
And how do you measure what is not very good?
Well, that's
something
true.
Which is sort of in the future.
It's hard. You could do with a kind of sort of like fund manager's performance back list of how they've been performing for people's money over the years. But I mean, that's probably quite a difficult thing to get hold of. As I say, it isn't easy and you need to do your research. The internet now means that a lot of people can't hide. And if you are a bad financial advisor, I would have thought that you're probably getting called out a little bit on various sort of websites and things. Thinking that sort of like unbiased is a good place to start. You can find financial advisors in your area and
ask around your friends and family.
Exactly. And that almost works on a bit of like a TripAdvisor type rating system, I think. So, you know, it's such a big decision because a lot of people might, you know, inherit a lot of money and don't know what to do with it, or they may, you know, come into retirement and they've got their pension and they're not sure what to do with it. You know, there's lots of variables
to it.
There's
only more choices to make now.
But just don't make a slapdash decision. Mm. Don't be pressured into anything. Go into there with as much knowledge, you know, with a meeting with a financial advisor, with as much knowledge as possible. And, you know, a lot of the time you can just get a good vibe from someone. So
absolutely,
it's hard. Right. It is hard though, Georgie. There's no totally correct answer.
I do think you're absolutely right. Arm yourself with as much knowledge, and it's all there on thisismoney.co.uk. Now, it's hard enough to live with them sometimes, but what about working with your family? Now, imagine you aren't the boss, your kids are. Now, many parents will probably feel like this is the situation in their households anyway, but welcome to the very modern world of family business, where young entrepreneurs are selling on apps like Depop, I think I've pronounced that right, as well as ASOS Marketplace and Etsy, making hundreds of pounds with the help of mum, dad, grandparents, siblings, you name it. Now, Simon, most people will probably be aware of ASOS, they do the clothes, and Etsy, crafts and creative stuff, right, that you make and whatnot. But Depop sounds like some Korean Depop. Kind of have I got that right? Or some American 90s young band.
I don't think that it is in any way connected to or inspired by Hanson. How Depop. So next time you see that avocado munching millennial sitting there using their phone, not talking to someone at the table, and you think, kids of today, that would never would have happened when I was that age.
Because
you didn't have smartphones for a start. So, and playing Snake wasn't that interesting.
Nor Avocado either, in my case. I don't remember that.
No, exactly. That's the thing. What? You know, all these complaints, these people can't afford houses because they eat all this avocado and they have these iPhones and they go on these foreign holidays and they buy these flat screen TVs. Well, you know what? Next time you do that, you might be wrong because that avocado munching, phone fixated man or girl, man or woman child,
maybe earning their money,
making some money.
Yeah.
Not only might they be making some money, they might be making some money in employing other members of their family. So this is a story.
Explain, Simon. Explain.
It was written by one of our colleagues on Money Mail, and it is about these young folk making money. And how they are making money is they're buying and selling things. For example, there is one chap who's carved out a pretty good niche in selling vintage trainers. And one of the places that a lot of these young adults are selling this stuff is a website called Depop, which, if you are older than about 22, you've probably never heard of in your life.
Don't feel so bad now, no.
But if you're down with the kids, then you will know what it is. And it's a good test, actually. If you want to test if someone is down with the kids, ask them, do you know Depop? And if they are, then they'll know the answer. But anyway, it's like a cross between eBay and Etsy, or a kind of like a cross between eBay and a social media thing, where people, they get a following and they show their looks and their styles. They buy some of them buy vintage clothes and then they update them and refresh them and sell them on. Some of them buy in-demand trainers, vintage trainers. It's quite fashion orientated.
Yeah, I'm looking
it's very,
at it now.
It's very picture orientated.
It's like Instagram.
It's like an Instagram,
ASOS,
eBay
thing,
Etsy, ASOS, Amazon Marketplace thing. And what it is, most importantly, is a way for people to build their brand, build their business, promote it to people, get people who follow their business, which is hugely important nowadays for people setting up this kind of business online, and also make some money. And there are lots of people, young people, entrepreneurial sorts, millennials, if you really want to call them that, and younger, in fact, teenagers even, who are doing very nicely out of it indeed and carving themselves out nice little businesses. And we've got and this story is great because it involves people, for example, who have then enlisted other members of their family to help them. So we've got a mother and a daughter who work together.
I'm interested in.
We've got a young lad called Daniel Wilmot who can sell between 20 and 50 pairs of trainers a day, and his granddad, 81, gives him business advice and helps him out.
Oh, brilliant.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, he said that his granddad's been telling his friends down the pub that he doesn't pay him. And they said, well, that's slave labour. But his granddad, it says here, granddad used to tell his friends in the pub that he was being exploited and have me impounded for slave labour. But he would never take any money. It's brilliant, isn't it?
Aww, nice story.
But yeah, look, this is great. These people are out there, you know, making some money, doing something entrepreneurial and doing a really good job of it. And I think Amelia's story here is a really good one because it shines a different light on the younger generation to the one that is often shone. And do you know what? There are lots of people doing this. There are lots of young people out there hustling to try and make money in an environment where they find it much, much harder to get jobs than the generations that came before them did. And also where if you don't have a degree now, it's kind of just expected that you have a degree. We send so many people to university that if you don't have a degree, it can be quite hard to get some jobs. And there's a stigma attached to it that there wasn't in days gone by. And you only have to look at a lot of very successful entrepreneurs who are now, you know, who are of the baby boomer generation. And they did exactly the same thing, started hustling. Richard Branson, Alan Sugar, people like that. And probably some of these people selling on Depop or ASOS Marketplace or other things like that will be the Alan Sugars and the Richard Bransons of the future. And it's not just reusing old clothes, of course, that people are using these platforms for. You've got people who are trying to build up businesses making new clothes that are doing it as well. I've got a friend who's doing this, my friend Marta. She's the wife of a friend of mine. They moved back to Italy, to Milan, and she's got two kids. And what she's always loved doing is making clothes. So she decided she was going to start doing this. designing clothes herself at home, then making them. She's managed to get a couple of people who are seamstresses working for her doing this. But in the old days, if you wanted to do this, what you're going to have to do with those clothes is you're either going to have to get them into a shop, or you're going to have to go to a market. Maybe you can do a market stall or something like that. That's probably the most direct equivalent of it. It's very difficult to get stuff into shops. You lose a lot of the money compared to the retail price of it. A market stall, for example, is great, but you have to rely on the people who have gone to that market, walking past your stall and seeing it. So what Marta did was she set this up, but then she decided to try and carve out a social media following. So she set up an Instagram account in the name of the business that she started up, which is called Double Stitched. And then she's been posting on that. She signed up to Etsy. She's posting pictures on Facebook. She's making the clothes, getting friends and family to model them. So there's clothes of kids. There's cute pictures of kids. There's also pictures of people wearing them. She's made a great play of the fact that it's made in Italy and everything like that. And she's selling them. And the great thing about doing it on these platforms, for example, promoting yourself on Instagram or being on Etsy or being on something like Depop, is it's not just the market stall where someone has to come to the market and walk past the market. People are seeing those. And if they like the picture and they share the picture, it's got that element where one person likes it and then another 10 or 20 people might see it. And if one of those likes it, another 10 or 20 people might see it. And so actually the market is basically the world. You've got your market stall, but the whole world could theoretically walk past it if they're on one of those social media accounts. So I think it is a really good way if you are going to try and set up a new business, particularly if it's something that is photogenic, of trying to get it out there.
You can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes? It helps people find us.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I Premium Bonds, creating millions of reasons to celebrate every month.